You invented the internet?
It was my idea, Martha said. Rats are delicious, George said.
It was my idea, Hermes said. I mean the internet, not the rats. But that's not the point. Percy, do you understand what I'm saying about family?
I'm not sure.
You will someday.
Hermes got up and brushed the sand off his legs.
In the meantime, I must be going.
You have 60 calls to return, Martha said. And 1,038 emails, George added, not counting the offers for online discount ambrosia.
And you, Percy, Hermes said, have a shorter deadline than you realize to complete your quest. Your friends should be coming right about now. I heard Annabeth's voice calling my name from the sand dunes. Tyson, too, was shouting from a little bit farther away.
I hope I packed well for you, Hermes said. I do have some experience with travel.
He snapped his fingers, and three yellow duffel bags appeared at my feet.
Waterproof, of course. If you ask nicely, your father should be able to help you reach the ship.
Ship? Hermes pointed. Sure enough, a big cruise ship was cutting across Long Island Sound, its white and gold lights glowing against the dark water.
Wait, I said. I don't understand any of this. I haven't even agreed to go.
I'd make up your mind in the next 5 minutes if I were you, Hermes advised. That's when the harpies will come to eat you. Now, good night, cousin. And dare I say it? May the gods go with you.
He opened his hand, and the caduceus flew into it.
Good luck, Martha told me. Bring me back a rat, George said.
The caduceus changed into a cell phone, and Hermes slipped it into his pocket. He jogged off down the beach. 20 paces away, he shimmered and vanished, leaving me alone with a thermos, a bottle of chewable vitamins, and 5 minutes to make an impossible decision. Chapter 8. We board the Princess Andromeda. I was staring at the waves when Annabeth and Tyson found me.
What's going on? Annabeth asked. I heard you calling for help.
Me too, Tyson said. Heard you yell, bad things are attacking.
I didn't call you guys, I said. I'm fine. But then who? Annabeth noticed the three yellow duffel bags, then the thermos, and the bottle of vitamins I was holding. What?
Just listen, I said. We don't have much time.
I told them about my conversation with Hermes. By the time I was finished, I could hear screeching in the distance. Patrol harpies picking up our scent.
Percy, Annabeth said. We have to do the quest.
We'll get expelled, you know. Trust me, I'm an expert at getting expelled.
So, if we fail, there won't be any camp to come back to.
Yeah, but you promised Chiron.
I promised I'd keep you from danger. I can only do that by coming with you. Tyson can stay behind and tell them...
I want to go,
Tyson said.
No.
Annabeth's voice sounded close to panic. I mean, Percy, come on. You know that's impossible. I wondered again why she had such a grudge against Cyclopes. There was something she wasn't telling me. She and Tyson both looked at me, waiting for an answer. Meanwhile, the cruise ship was getting farther and farther away. The thing was, part of me didn't want Tyson along. I'd spent the last 3 days in close quarters with the guy, getting razzed by the other campers and embarrassed a million times a day, constantly reminded that I was related to him. I needed some space. Plus, I didn't know how much help he'd be, or how I'd keep him safe. Sure, he was strong, but Tyson was a little kid in Cyclops terms, maybe 7 or 8 years old, mentally. I could see him freaking out and starting to cry while we were trying to sneak past a monster or something.
He'd get us all killed. On the other hand, the sound of the harpies was getting closer. We can't leave him, I decided. Tantalus will punish him for us being gone. Percy, Annabeth said, trying to keep her cool. We're going to Polyphemus' island. Polyphemus is an S-I-K-A-C-Y-K. She stamped her foot in frustration. As smart as she was, Annabeth was dyslexic, too. We could have been there all night while she tried to spell Cyclops. You know what I mean. Tyson can go, I insisted, if he wants to. Tyson clapped his hands.
Want to?
Annabeth gave me the evil eye, but I guess she could tell I wasn't going to change my mind. Or maybe she just knew we didn't have time to argue. All right, she said. How do we get to that ship? Hermes said my father would help. Well then, seaweed brain, what are you waiting for? I'd always had a hard time calling on my father, or praying, or whatever you want to call it, but I stepped into the waves. Dad? I called. How's it going? Percy, Annabeth whispered, we're in a hurry. We need your help, I called a little louder. We need to get to that ship, like, before we get eaten and stuff, so... At first, nothing happened. Waves crashed against the shore like normal. The harpies sounded like they were right behind the sand dunes. Then, about 100 yards out to sea, 3 white lines appeared on the surface. They moved fast toward the shore like claws ripping through the ocean. As they neared the beach, the surf burst apart and the heads of 3 white stallions reared out of the waves. Tyson caught his breath.
Fish ponies!
He was right. As the creatures pulled themselves onto the sand, I saw that they were only horses in the front. Their back halves were silvery fish bodies, with glistening scales and rainbow tail fins. Hippocampi, Annabeth said. They're beautiful. The nearest one whinnied in appreciation and nuzzled Annabeth. We'll admire them later, I said. Come on.
There. A voice screeched behind us. Bad children out of cabins. Snack time for lucky harpies.
5 of them were fluttering over the top of the dunes. Plump little hags with pinched faces and talons and feathery wings too small for their bodies. They reminded me of miniature cafeteria ladies who'd been crossbred with dodo birds. They weren't very fast, thank the gods. But they were vicious if they caught you. Tyson, I said, grab a duffel bag. He was still staring at the hippocampi with his mouth hanging open. Tyson!
Huh?
Come on! With Annabeth's help, I got him moving. We gathered the bags and mounted our steeds. Poseidon must have known Tyson was one of the passengers, because one hippocampus was much larger than the other two, just right for carrying a cyclops. Giddy up, I said. My hippocampus turned and plunged into the waves. Annabeth's and Tyson's followed right behind. The harpies cursed at us, wailing for their snacks to come back, but the hippocampi raced over the water at the speed of jet skis. The harpies fell behind, and soon the shore of Camp Half-Blood was nothing but a dark smudge. I wondered if I'd ever see the place again. But right then, I had other problems. The cruise ship was now looming in front of us. Our ride toward Florida and the Sea of Monsters. Riding the hippocampus was even easier than riding a Pegasus. We zipped along with the wind in our faces, speeding through the waves so smooth and steady, I hardly needed to hold on at all. As we got closer to the cruise ship, I realized just how huge it was. I felt as though I were looking up at a building in Manhattan. The white hull was at least 10 stories tall, topped with another 12 levels of decks with brightly lit balconies and portholes. The ship's name was painted just above the bow line in black letters, lit with a spotlight. It took me a few seconds to decipher it. Princess Andromeda. Attached to the bow was a huge masthead, a three-story-tall woman wearing a white Greek chiton sculpted to look as if she were chained to the front of the ship. She was young and beautiful, with flowing black hair, but her expression was one of absolute terror. Why anybody would want a screaming princess on the front of their vacation ship, I had no idea. I remembered the myth about Andromeda and how she had been chained to a rock by her own parents as a sacrifice to a sea monster. Maybe she'd gotten too many Fs on her report card or something. Anyway, my namesake, Perseus, had saved her just in time and turned the sea monster to stone using the head of Medusa. That Perseus always won. That's why my mom had named me after him, even though he was a son of Zeus and I was a son of Poseidon. The original Perseus was one of the only heroes in the Greek myths who got a happy ending. The others died, betrayed, mauled, mutilated, poisoned, or cursed by the gods. My mom hoped I would inherit Perseus's luck. Judging by how my life was going so far, I wasn't real optimistic.
"How do we get aboard?"
Annabeth shouted over the noise of the waves. But the hippocampi seemed to know what we needed. They skimmed along the starboard side of the ship, riding easily through its huge wake, and pulled up next to a service ladder riveted to the side of the hull. "You first," I told Annabeth. She slung her duffel bag over her shoulder and grabbed the bottom rung. Once she'd hoisted herself onto the ladder, her hippocampus whinnied a farewell and dove underwater. Annabeth began to climb. I let her get a few rungs up, then followed her. Finally, it was just Tyson in the water. His hippocampus was treating him to 360-degree aerials and backward ollies, and Tyson was laughing so hysterically, the sound echoed up the side of the ship. "Tyson, shh," I said. "Come on, big guy."
"Can't we take Rainbow?"
he asked, his smile fading. I stared at him. "Rainbow?" The hippocampus whinnied as if he liked his new name. "We have to go," I said. "Rainbow? Well, he can't climb ladders." Tyson sniffled. He buried his face in the hippocampus's mane.
"I will miss you, Rainbow."
The hippocampus made a neighing sound I could have sworn was crying. "Maybe we'll see him again sometime," I suggested.
"Oh, please,"
Tyson said, perking up immediately.
"Tomorrow."
I didn't make any promises, but I finally convinced Tyson to say his farewells and grab hold of the ladder. With a final sad whinny, Rainbow the hippocampus did a backflip and dove into the sea. The ladder led to a maintenance deck stacked with yellow lifeboats. There was a set of locked double doors, which Annabeth managed to pry open with her knife and a fair amount of cursing in ancient Greek. I figured we'd have to sneak around, being stowaways and all, but after checking a few corridors and peering over a balcony into a huge central promenade lined with closed shops, I began to realize there was nobody to hide from. I mean, sure it was the middle of the night, but we walked half the length of the boat and met no one. We passed 40 or 50 cabin doors and heard no sound behind any of them. "It's a ghost ship," I murmured.
"No,"
Tyson said, fiddling with the strap of his duffel bag.
"Bad smell."
Annabeth frowned. "I don't smell anything." "Cyclopes are like satyrs," I said. "They can smell monsters. Isn't that right, Tyson?" He nodded nervously. Now that we were away from Camp Half-Blood, the mist had distorted his face again. Unless I concentrated very hard, it seemed that he had two eyes instead of one. "Okay," Annabeth said. "So what exactly do you smell?"
"Something bad,"
Tyson answered. "Great," Annabeth grumbled. "That clears it up." We came outside on the swimming pool level. There were rows of empty deck chairs and a bar closed off with a chain curtain.
The water in the pool glowed eerily, sloshing back and forth from the motion of the ship. Above us, fore and aft, were more levels. A climbing wall, a putt-putt golf course, a revolving restaurant, but no sign of life. And yet, I sensed something familiar, something dangerous. I had the feeling that if I weren't so tired and burned out on adrenaline from our long night, I might be able to put a name to what was wrong. "We need a hiding place," I said. "Somewhere safe to sleep." "Sleep," Annabeth agreed wearily. We explored a few more corridors until we found an empty suite on the 9th level. The door was open, which struck me as weird. There was a basket of chocolate goodies on the table, an iced-down bottle of sparkling cider on the nightstand, and a mint on the pillow with a handwritten note that said, "Enjoy your cruise." We opened our duffel bags for the first time and found that Hermes really had thought of everything. Extra clothes, toiletries, camp rations, a Ziploc bag full of cash, a leather pouch full of golden drachmas. He'd even managed to pack Tyson's oilcloth with his tools and metal bits and Annabeth's cap of invisibility, which made them both feel a lot better. "I'll be next door," Annabeth said. "You guys don't drink or eat anything." "You think this place is enchanted?" She frowned. "I don't know. Something isn't right. Just be careful." We locked our doors. Tyson crashed on the couch. He tinkered for a few minutes on his metalworking project, which he still wouldn't show me. But soon enough, he was yawning. He wrapped up his oilcloth and passed out. I lay on the bed and stared out the porthole. I thought I heard voices out in the hallway, like whispering. I knew that couldn't be. We'd walked all over the ship and had seen nobody. But the voices kept me awake. They reminded me of my trip to the underworld, the way the spirits of the dead sounded as they drifted past. Finally, my weariness got the best of me. I fell asleep and had my worst dream yet. I was standing in a cavern at the edge of an enormous pit. I knew the place too well, the entrance to Tartarus. And I recognized the cold laugh that echoed from the darkness below.
"If it isn't the young hero."
The voice was like a knife blade scraping across stone.
"On his way to another great victory."
I wanted to shout at Kronos to leave me alone. I wanted to draw Riptide and strike him down. But I couldn't move. And even if I could, how could I kill something that had already been destroyed, chopped to pieces and cast into eternal darkness?
"Don't let me stop you," the Titan said. "Perhaps this time, when you fail, you'll wonder if it's worthwhile slaving for the gods. How exactly has your father shown his appreciation lately?"
His laughter filled the cavern, and suddenly the scene changed. It was a different cave. Grover's bedroom prison in the Cyclops' lair. Grover was sitting at the loom in his soiled wedding dress, madly unraveling the threads of the unfinished bridal train.
"Honey pie!"
the monster shouted from behind the boulder. Grover yelped and began weaving the threads back together. The room shook as the boulder was pushed aside. Looming in the doorway was a Cyclops, so huge he made Tyson look vertically challenged. He had jagged yellow teeth and gnarled hands as big as my whole body. He wore a faded purple t-shirt that said, "World Sheep Expo 2001. He must have been at least 15 feet tall, but the most startling thing was his enormous milky eye, scarred and webbed with cataracts. If he wasn't completely blind, he had to be pretty darn close.
"What are you doing?"
the monster demanded.
"Nothing," Grover said in his falsetto voice. "Just weaving my bridal train, as you can see." the Cyclops stuck one hand into the room and groped around until he found the loom. He pawed at the cloth.
It hasn't gotten any longer.
Oh, yes it has, dearest. See? I've added at least an inch.
Too many delays,
the monster bellowed. Then he sniffed the air.
You smell good, like goats.
Oh, Grover forced a weak giggle. Do you like it? It's eau de chèvre. I wore it just for you.
The
Cyclops bared his pointed teeth.
Good enough to eat.
Oh, you're such a flirt.
No more delays.
But, dear, I'm not done.
Tomorrow.
No, 10 more days.
5.
Oh, well, 7 then, if you insist.
7. That is less than 5, right?
Certainly. Oh, yes.
The monster grumbled, still not happy with his deal, but he left Grover to his weaving and rolled the boulder back into place. Grover closed his eyes and took a shaky breath, trying to calm his nerves.
Hurry, Percy, he muttered. Please, please, please.
I woke to a ship's whistle and a voice on the intercom. Some guy with an Australian accent who sounded way too happy.
Good morning, passengers. We'll be at sea all day today. Excellent weather for the poolside mambo party. Don't forget $1 million bingo in the Kraken Lounge at 1 o'clock. And for our special guests, disemboweling practice on the promenade.
I sat up in bed. What did he say? Tyson groaned, still half asleep. He was lying face down on the couch, his feet so far over the edge, they were in the bathroom.
The happy man said, bowling practice?
I hoped he was right, but then there was an urgent knock on the suite's interior door. Annabeth stuck her head in, her blonde hair in a rat's nest.
Disemboweling practice?
Once we were all dressed, we ventured out into the ship and were surprised to see other people. A dozen senior citizens were heading to breakfast. A dad was taking his kids to the pool for a morning swim. Crew members in crisp white uniforms strolled the deck, tipping their hats to the passengers. Nobody asked who we were. Nobody paid us much attention, but there was something wrong. As the family of swimmers passed us, the dad told his kids,
"We are on a cruise. We are having fun."
"Yes," his three kids said in unison, their expressions blank. "We are having a blast. We will swim in the pool." They wandered off.
"Good morning,"
a crew member told us, his eyes glazed. "We are all enjoying ourselves aboard the Princess Andromeda. Have a nice day." He drifted away.
"Percy, this is weird," Annabeth whispered. "They're all in some kind of trance."
Then we passed a cafeteria and saw our first monster. It was a hellhound, a black mastiff with its front paws up in the buffet line and its muzzle buried in the scrambled eggs. It must have been young, because it was small compared to most. No bigger than a grizzly bear. Still, my blood turned cold. I'd almost gotten killed by one of those before. The weird thing was, a middle-aged couple was standing in the buffet line right behind the devil dog, patiently waiting their turn for the eggs. They didn't seem to notice anything out of the ordinary.
"Not hungry anymore,"
Tyson murmured. Before Annabeth or I could reply, a reptilian voice came from down the corridor.
6 more joined yesterday.
Annabeth gestured frantically toward the nearest hiding place, the women's room, and all three of us ducked inside. I was so freaked out, it didn't even occur to me to be embarrassed.
Something, or more like two somethings, slithered past the bathroom door, making sounds like sandpaper against the carpet.
Yes, a second reptilian voice said. He draws them. Soon we will be strong.
The thing slithered into the cafeteria with a cold hissing that might have been snake laughter. Annabeth looked at me.
We have to get out of here.
You think I want to be in the girls' restroom?
I mean the ship, Percy. We have to get off the ship.
Smells bad,
Tyson agreed.
And dogs eat all the eggs. Annabeth is right. We must leave the restroom and ship.
I shuddered. If Annabeth and Tyson were actually agreeing about something, I figured I'd better listen. Then I heard another voice outside, one that chilled me worse than any monster's.
Only a matter of time. Don't push me, Ogrius.
It was Luke, beyond a doubt. I could never forget his voice.
I'm not pushing you, another guy growled.
His voice was deeper and even angrier than Luke's.
I'm just saying, if this gamble doesn't pay off...
It'll pay off,
Luke snapped.
They'll take the bait. Now, come, we've got to get to the Admiralty suite and check on the casket.
Their voices receded down the corridor. Tyson whimpered.
Leave now?
Annabeth and I exchanged looks and came to a silent agreement.
We can't, I told Tyson.
We have to find out what Luke is up to, Annabeth agreed. And if possible, we're going to beat him up, bind him in chains, and drag him to Mount Olympus. Chapter 9. I have the worst family reunion ever. Annabeth volunteered to go alone, since she had the cap of invisibility, but I convinced her it was too dangerous. Either we all went together, or nobody went.
Nobody,
Tyson voted.
Please?
But in the end, he came along, nervously chewing on his huge fingernails. We stopped at our cabin long enough to gather our stuff. We figured whatever happened, we would not be staying another night aboard the zombie cruise ship, even if they did have million-dollar bingo. I made sure Riptide was in my pocket, and the vitamins and thermos from Hermes were at the top of my bag. I didn't want Tyson to carry everything, but he insisted, and Annabeth told me not to worry about it. Tyson could carry 3 full duffel bags over his shoulder as easily as I could carry a backpack. We sneaked through the corridors, following the ship's "You Are Here" signs toward the Admiralty suite. Annabeth scouted ahead invisibly. We hid whenever someone passed by, but most of the people we saw were just glassy-eyed zombie passengers. As we came up the stairs to Deck 13, where the Admiralty suite was supposed to be, Annabeth hissed, "Hide!" and shoved us into a supply closet. I heard a couple of guys coming down the hall.
"You see that Ethiopian dragon in the cargo hold?"
one of them said. The other laughed.
"Yeah, it's awesome."
Annabeth was still invisible, but she squeezed my arm hard. I got a feeling I should know that second guy's voice.
"I hear they got 2 more coming," the familiar voice said. "They keep arriving at this rate? Oh man, no contest."
The voices faded down the corridor.
That was Chris Rodriguez.
Annabeth took off her cap and turned visible.
"You remember, from Cabin 11.
I sort of recalled Chris from the summer before. He was one of those undetermined campers who got stuck in the Hermes cabin because his Olympian dad or mom never claimed him. Now that I thought about it, I realized I hadn't seen Chris at camp this summer. What's another half-blood doing here? Annabeth shook her head, clearly troubled.
We kept going down the corridor. I didn't need maps anymore to know I was getting close to Luke. I sensed something cold and unpleasant. The presence of evil.
Percy!
Annabeth stopped suddenly.
Look!
She stood in front of a glass wall looking down into the multi-story canyon that ran through the middle of the ship. At the bottom was the promenade, a mall full of shops. But that's not what had caught Annabeth's attention. A group of monsters had assembled in front of the candy store. A dozen Laestrygonian giants like the ones who'd attacked me with dodgeballs, two hellhounds, and a few even stranger creatures, humanoid females with twin serpent tails instead of legs.
"Scythian Dracaena," Annabeth whispered. "Dragon women."
The monsters made a semicircle around a young guy in Greek armor who was hacking on a straw dummy. A lump formed in my throat when I realized the dummy was wearing an orange Camp Half-Blood t-shirt. As we watched, the guy in armor stabbed the dummy through its belly and ripped upward. Straw flew everywhere. The monsters cheered and howled. Annabeth stepped away from the window. Her face was ashen.
"Come on,"
I told her, trying to sound braver than I felt. "The sooner we find Luke, the better." At the end of the hallway were double oak doors that looked like they must lead somewhere important. When we were 30 feet away, Tyson stopped.
"Voices inside."
"You can hear that far?" I asked. Tyson closed his eye like he was concentrating hard. Then his voice changed, becoming a husky approximation of Luke's.
"The prophecy ourselves. The fools won't know which way to turn."
Before I could react, Tyson's voice changed again, becoming deeper and gruffer, like the other guy we'd heard talking to Luke outside the cafeteria.
"You really think the old horseman is gone for good?"
Tyson laughed Luke's laugh.
"They can't trust him. Not with the skeletons in his closet. The poisoning of the tree was the final straw."
Annabeth shivered. "Stop that, Tyson. How do you do that? It's creepy." Tyson opened his eye and looked puzzled.
"Just listening."
"Keep going," I said. "What else are they saying?" Tyson closed his eye again. He hissed in the gruff man's voice.
"Quiet."
Then Luke's voice, whispering.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes,"
Tyson said in the gruff voice.
"Right outside."
Too late, I realized what was happening. I just had time to say, "Run!" when the doors of the stateroom burst open, and there was Luke, flanked by two hairy giants armed with javelins, their bronze tips aimed right at our chests.
"Well," Luke said with a crooked smile, "if it isn't my two favorite cousins, come right in."
The stateroom was beautiful, and it was horrible. The beautiful part? Huge windows curved along the back wall, looking out over the stern of the ship. Green sea and blue sky stretched all the way to the horizon. A Persian rug covered the floor. Two plush sofas occupied the middle of the room, with a canopied bed in one corner and a mahogany dining table in the other. The table was loaded with food. Pizza boxes, bottles of soda, and a stack of roast beef sandwiches on a silver platter. The horrible part? On a velvet dais at the back of the room lay a 10-foot-long golden casket. A sarcophagus engraved with ancient Greek scenes of cities in flames and heroes dying grisly deaths. Despite the sunlight streaming through the windows, the casket made the whole room feel cold.
"Well," Luke said, spreading his arms proudly, "a little nicer than Cabin 11, huh?"
He'd changed since the last summer. Instead of Bermuda shorts and a t-shirt, he wore a button-down shirt, khaki pants, and leather loafers. His sandy hair, which used to be so unruly, was now clipped short.
He looked like an evil male model, showing off what the fashionable college-age villain was wearing to Harvard this year. He still had the scar under his eye, a jagged white line from his battle with a dragon. And propped against the sofa was his magical sword, Backbiter, glinting strangely with its half-steel, half-celestial bronze blade that could kill both mortals and monsters.
"Sit," he told us.
He waved his hand, and three dining chairs scooted themselves into the center of the room. None of us sat. Luke's large friends were still pointing their javelins at us. They looked like twins, but they weren't human. They stood about 8 feet tall, for one thing, and wore only blue jeans, probably because their enormous chests were already shag carpeted with thick brown fur. They had claws for fingernails, feet like paws. Their noses were snout-like, and their teeth were all pointed canines.
"Where are my manners?" Luke said smoothly. "These are my assistants, Agrius and Aureus. Perhaps you've heard of them?"
I said nothing. Despite the javelins pointed at me, it wasn't the bear twins who scared me. I'd imagined meeting Luke again many times since he tried to kill me last summer. I'd pictured myself boldly standing up to him, challenging him to a duel. But now that we were face to face, I could barely stop my hands from shaking.
"You don't know Agrius and Aureus' story?" Luke asked. "Their mother? Well, it's sad, really. Aphrodite ordered the young woman to fall in love. She refused and ran to Artemis for help. Artemis let her become one of her maiden huntresses, but Aphrodite got her revenge. She bewitched the young woman into falling in love with a bear. When Artemis found out, she abandoned the girl in disgust. Typical of the gods, wouldn't you say? They fight with one another, and the poor humans get caught in the middle. The girl's twin sons here, Agrius and Aureus, have no love for Olympus. They like half-bloods well enough, though."
"For lunch," Agrius growled.
His gruff voice was the one I'd heard talking with Luke earlier. His brother Aureus laughed, licking his fur-lined lips. He kept laughing like he was having an asthmatic fit until Luke and Agrius both stared at him.
"Shut up, you idiot," Agrius growled. "Go punish yourself."
Aureus whimpered. He trudged over to the corner of the room, slumped onto a stool, and banged his forehead against the dining table, making the silver plates rattle. Luke acted like this was perfectly normal behavior. He made himself comfortable on the sofa and propped his feet up on the coffee table.
"Well, Percy, we let you survive another year. I hope you appreciated it. How's your mom? How's school?"
"You poisoned Thalia's tree." Luke sighed.
"Right to the point, huh? Okay, sure, I poisoned the tree. So what?"
"How could you?"
Annabeth sounded so angry, I thought she'd explode.
"Thalia saved your life, our lives. How could you dishonor her?"
"I didn't dishonor her," Luke snapped. "The gods dishonored her, Annabeth. If Thalia were alive, she'd be on my side."
"Liar."
"If you knew what was coming, you'd understand."
"I understand you want to destroy the camp," she yelled. "You're a monster."
Luke shook his head.
"The gods have blinded you. Can't you imagine a world without them, Annabeth? What good is that ancient history you study? 3,000 years of baggage? The West is rotten to the core. It has to be destroyed. Join me. We can start the world anew. We could use your intelligence, Annabeth."
"Because you have none of your own."
His eyes narrowed.
"I know you, Annabeth. You deserve better than tagging along on some hopeless quest to save the camp. Half-Blood Hill will be overrun by monsters within a month, The heroes who survive will have no choice but to join us or be hunted to extinction. You really want to be on a losing team with company like this?
Luke pointed at Tyson.
Hey,
I said.
Traveling with a Cyclops,
Luke chided.
Talk about dishonoring Thalia's memory. I'm surprised at you, Annabeth, you of all people.
Stop it,
she shouted. I didn't know what Luke was talking about, but Annabeth buried her head in her hands like she was about to cry.
Leave her alone, I said, and leave Tyson out of this.
Luke laughed.
Oh, yeah, I heard. Your father claimed him.
I must have looked surprised because Luke smiled.
Yes, Percy, I know all about that. And about your plan to find the fleece. What were those coordinates again? 30, 31, 75, 12. You see, I still have friends at camp who keep me posted.
Spies, you mean?
He shrugged.
How many insults from your father can you stand, Percy? You think he's grateful to you? You think Poseidon cares for you any more than he cares for this monster?
Tyson clenched his fists and made a rumbling sound down in his throat. Luke just chuckled.
The gods are so using you, Percy. Do you have any idea what's in store for you if you reach your 16th birthday? Has Chiron even told you the prophecy?
I wanted to get in Luke's face and tell him off, but as usual, he knew just how to throw me off balance. 16th birthday? I mean, I knew Chiron had received the prophecy from the Oracle many years ago. I knew part of it was about me, but if I reached my 16th birthday, I didn't like the sound of that.
I know what I need to know, I managed, like who my enemies are.
Then you're a fool.
Tyson smashed the nearest dining chair to splinters.
Percy is not a fool.
Before I could stop him, he charged Luke. His fists came down toward Luke's head, a double overhead blow that would have knocked a hole in titanium. But the Bear Twins intercepted. They each caught one of Tyson's arms and stopped him cold. They pushed him back, and Tyson stumbled. He fell to the carpet so hard the deck shook.
Too bad, Cyclops, Luke said. Looks like my grisly friends together are more than a match for your strength. Maybe I should let them...
Luke, I cut in, listen to me. Your father sent us.
His face turned the color of pepperoni.
Don't even mention him.
He told us to take this boat. I thought it was just for a ride, but he sent us here to find you. He told me he won't give up on you, no matter how angry you are.
Angry? Luke roared. Give up on me? He abandoned me, Percy. I want Olympus destroyed, every throne crushed to rubble. You tell Hermes it's gonna happen too. Each time a half-blood joins us, the Olympians grow weaker and we grow stronger. He grows stronger.
Luke pointed to the gold sarcophagus. The box creeped me out, but I was determined not to show it.
So?
I demanded. What's so special? Then it hit me. What might be inside the sarcophagus? The temperature in the room seemed to drop 20 degrees.
Whoa, you don't mean...
He is reforming, Luke said. Little by little, we're calling his life force out of the pit. With every recruit who pledges our cause, another small piece appears.
That's disgusting, Annabeth said.
Luke sneered at her.
Huh, your mother was born from Zeus's split skull, Annabeth. I wouldn't talk. Soon there will be enough of the Titan Lord so that we can make him whole again. We will piece together a new body for him, a work worthy of the forges of Hephaestus.
You're insane, Annabeth said.
Join us and you'll be rewarded. We have powerful friends, sponsors rich enough to buy this cruise ship, and much more. Percy, your mother will never have to work again. You can buy her a mansion, you could have power, fame, whatever you want. Annabeth, you can realize your dream of being an architect. You can build a monument to last 1,000 years, a temple to the lords of the next age.
Go to Tartarus, she said. Luke sighed.
A shame.
He picked up something that looked like a TV remote and pressed a red button. Within seconds, the door of the stateroom opened and 2 uniformed crew members came in, armed with nightsticks. They had the same glassy-eyed look as the other mortals I'd seen, but I had a feeling this wouldn't make them any less dangerous in a fight.
Ah, good. Security, Luke said. I'm afraid we have some stowaways.
Yes, sir, they said dreamily. Luke turned to Uraeus.
It's time to feed the Ethiopian dragon. Take these fools below and show them how it's done.
Uraeus grinned stupidly.
Heh 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 heh.
Let me go too, Agrius grumbled. My brother is worthless. That Cyclops is no threat, Luke said.
He glanced back at the golden casket as if something were troubling him.
Agrius, stay here. We have important matters to discuss. But, Uraeus, don't fail me. Stay in the hold to make sure the dragon is properly fed.
Uraeus prodded us with his javelin and herded us out of the stateroom, followed by the 2 human security guards. As I walked down the corridor with Uraeus's javelin poking me in the back, I thought about what Luke had said, that the bear twins together were a match for Tyson's strength, but maybe separately? We exited the corridor amidships and walked across an open deck lined with lifeboats. I knew the ship well enough to realize this would be our last look at sunlight. Once we got to the other side, we'd take the elevator down into the hold, and that would be it. I looked at Tyson and said, "Now!" Thank the gods he understood. He turned and smacked Uraeus 30 feet backward into the swimming pool, right into the middle of the zombie tourist family. The kids yelled in unison. We are not having a blast in the pool. One of the security guards drew his nightstick, but Annabeth knocked the wind out of him with a well-placed kick. The other guard ran for the nearest alarm box. Stop him! Annabeth yelled, but it was too late. Just before I banged him on the head with a deck chair, he hit the alarm. Red lights flashed. Sirens wailed. Lifeboat! I yelled. We ran for the nearest one. By the time we got the cover off, monsters and more security men were swarming the deck, pushing aside tourists and waiters with trays of tropical drinks. A guy in Greek armor drew his sword and charged, but slipped in a puddle of piña colada. Laestrygonian archers assembled on the deck above us, notching arrows in their enormous bows. How do you launch this thing? Screamed Annabeth. A hellhound leaped at me, but Tyson slammed it aside with a fire extinguisher. Get in! I yelled. I uncapped Riptide and slashed the first volley of arrows out of the air. Any second we would be overwhelmed. The lifeboat was hanging over the side of the ship, high above the water. Annabeth and Tyson were having no luck with the release pulley. I jumped in beside them. Hold on! I yelled, and I cut the ropes. A shower of arrows whistled over our heads as we free fell toward the ocean. Chapter 10. We hitch a ride with dead Confederates.
Thermos!
I screamed as we hurtled toward the water.
What?
Annabeth must have thought I'd lost my mind. She was holding on to the boat straps for dear life, her hair flying straight up like a torch.
But Tyson understood. He managed to open my duffel bag and take out Hermes's magical thermos without losing his grip on it or the boat. Arrows and javelins whistled past us. I grabbed the thermos and hoped I was doing the right thing. Hang on! I am hanging on! Annabeth yelled. Tighter! I hooked my feet under the boat's inflatable bench, and as Tyson grabbed Annabeth and me by the backs of our shirts, I gave the thermos cap a quarter turn. Instantly, a white sheet of wind jetted out of the thermos and propelled us sideways, turning our downward plummet into a 45-degree crash landing. The wind seemed to laugh as it shot from the thermos, like it was glad to be free. As we hit the ocean, we bumped once, twice, skipping like a stone, then we were whizzing along like a speedboat, salt spray in our faces and nothing but sea ahead. I heard a wail of outrage from the ship behind us, but we were already out of weapon range. The Princess Andromeda faded to the size of a white toy boat in the distance, and then it was gone. As we raced over the sea, Annabeth and I tried to send an iris message to Chiron. We figured it was important we let somebody know what Luke was doing, and we didn't know who else to trust. The wind from the thermos stirred up a nice sea spray that made a rainbow in the sunlight. Perfect for an iris message, but our connection was still poor. When Annabeth threw a gold drachma into the mist and prayed for the rainbow goddess to show us Chiron, his face appeared all right, but there was some kind of weird strobe light flashing in the background and rock music blaring like he was at a dance club. We told him about sneaking away from camp, and Luke, and the Princess Andromeda, and the golden box for Kronos' remains. But between the noise on his end, and the rushing wind and water on our end, I'm not sure how much he heard.
Percy! Chiron yelled. You have to watch out for...
His voice was drowned out by loud shouting behind him, a bunch of voices whooping it up like Comanche warriors.
What?
I yelled.
Curse my relatives!
Chiron ducked as a plate flew over his head and shattered somewhere out of sight.
Annabeth, you shouldn't have let Percy leave camp. But if you do get the fleece...
Yeah, baby!
Somebody behind Chiron yelled.
Woohoo!
The music got cranked up, subwoofers so loud it made our boat vibrate.
Miami! Chiron was yelling. I'll try to keep watch.
Our misty screen smashed apart like someone on the other side had thrown a bottle at it, and Chiron was gone. An hour later, we spotted land, a long stretch of beach lined with high-rise hotels. The water became crowded with fishing boats and tankers. A Coast Guard cruiser passed on our starboard side, then turned like it wanted a second look. I guess it isn't every day they see a yellow lifeboat with no engine going 100 knots an hour, manned by three kids.
That's Virginia Beach, Annabeth said as we approached the shoreline. Oh my gods, how did the Princess Andromeda travel so far overnight? That's like...
530 nautical miles, I said.
She stared at me. How did you know that?
I'm not sure.
Annabeth thought for a moment.
Percy, what's our position?
36 degrees, 44 minutes north, 76 degrees, 2 minutes west, I said immediately.
Then I shook my head. Whoa, how did I know that?
Because of your dad, Annabeth guessed. When you're at sea, you have perfect bearings. That is so cool.
I wasn't sure about that. I didn't want to be a human GPS unit. But before I could say anything, Tyson tapped my shoulder.
Other boat is coming.
I looked back. The Coast Guard vessel was definitely on our tail now. Its lights were flashing, and it was gaining speed.
We can't let them catch us, I said. They'll ask too many questions.
Keep going into Chesapeake Bay, Annabeth said. I know a place we can hide. I didn't ask what she meant, or how she knew the area so well.
I risked loosening the thermos cap a little more, and a fresh burst of wind sent us rocketing around the northern tip of Virginia Beach into Chesapeake Bay. The Coast Guard boat fell farther and farther behind. We didn't slow down until the shores of the bay narrowed on either side, and I realized we'd entered the mouth of a river. I could feel the change from salt water to fresh water. Suddenly, I was tired and frazzled, like I was coming down off a sugar high. I didn't know where I was anymore, or which way to steer the boat. It was a good thing Annabeth was directing me. "There," she said, "past that sandbar." We veered into a swampy area choked with marsh grass. I beached the lifeboat at the foot of a giant cypress. Vine-covered trees loomed above us. Insects chirred in the woods. The air was muggy and hot, and steam curled off the river. Basically, it wasn't Manhattan, and I didn't like it. "Come on," Annabeth said. "It's just down the bank." "What is?" I asked. "Just follow." She grabbed a duffel bag. "And we'd better cover the boat. We don't want to draw attention." After burying the lifeboat with branches, Tyson and I followed Annabeth along the shore, our feet sinking in red mud. A snake slithered past my shoe and disappeared into the grass.
"Not a good place," Tyson said.
He swatted the mosquitoes that were forming a buffet line on his arm. After another few minutes, Annabeth said, "Here." All I saw was a patch of brambles. Then Annabeth moved aside a woven circle of branches, like a door, and I realized I was looking into a camouflaged shelter. The inside was big enough for three, even with Tyson being the third. The walls were woven from plant material, like a Native American hut, but they looked pretty waterproof. Stacked in the corner was everything you could want for a campout: sleeping bags, blankets, an ice chest, and a kerosene lamp. There were demigod provisions, too. Bronze javelin tips, a quiver full of arrows, an extra sword, and a box of ambrosia. The place smelled musty, like it had been vacant for a long time. "A half-blood hideout." I looked at Annabeth in awe. "You made this place?"
"Thalia and I," she said quietly, "and Luke."
That shouldn't have bothered me. I mean, I knew Thalia and Luke had taken care of Annabeth when she was little. I knew the three of them had been runaways together, hiding from monsters, surviving on their own before Grover found them and tried to get them to Half-Blood Hill. But whenever Annabeth talked about the time she'd spent with them, I kind of felt, I don't know, uncomfortable? No, that's not the word. The word was jealous. "So," I said, "you don't think Luke will look for us here?" She shook her head. "We made a dozen safe houses like this. I doubt Luke even remembers where they are, or cares." She threw herself down on the blankets and started going through her duffel bag. Her body language made it pretty clear she didn't want to talk. Tyson," I said, "would you mind scouting around outside? Like look for a wilderness convenience store or something?"
"Convenience store?"
"Yeah, for snacks, powdered donuts or something. Just don't go too far."
"Powdered donuts,"
Tyson said earnestly.
"I will look for powdered donuts in the wilderness."
He headed outside and started calling,
"Here, donuts."
Once he was gone, I sat down across from Annabeth. "Hey, sorry about, you know, seeing Luke." "It's not your fault." She unsheathed her knife and started cleaning the blade with a rag. "He let us go too easily," I said. I'd hoped I'd been imagining it, but Annabeth nodded. I was thinking the same thing. What we overheard him say about a gamble and they'll take the bait, I think he was talking about us. "The fleece is the bait, or Grover?" She studied the edge of her knife. "I don't know, Percy. Maybe he wants the fleece for himself. Maybe he's hoping we'll do the hard work, and then he can steal it from us.
I just can't believe he would poison the tree.
What did he mean? I asked. That Thalia would have been on his side?
He's wrong.
You don't sound sure. Annabeth glared at me, and I started to wish I hadn't asked her about this while she was holding a knife.